Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll cut through the noise with interviews, insight, and answers from people who make decisions. You will, I hope, leave knowing more than when you arrived. Coming up. Transnet narrows its losses, but is the freight rebound finally sustainable? What South Africans really order when no one's watching, Uber Eats lifts the lid on 2025. A vegetable ban shock, Botswana's move leaves South African farmers scrambling, and new premiums, new risk rules, what to check out before you switch insurers. It's Monday, the 15th of December. Now, Transnet has narrowed its half-year loss to 1.8 billion, helped by improved freight rail volumes and a slightly stronger operational performance. Now, I think while the numbers point to stabilization after years of decline, the business still faces challenges, aging infrastructure, security risks to funding constraints and broader reform pressure. And I think the key question now is whether this improvement marks the start of a durable turnaround or maybe just a temporary reprieve. Well, let me put that question to the Group Chief Executive Officer of Transnet, Michelle Phillips. A very warm welcome to you. And what tells you that this is a real turnaround and not just a temporary bounce?
Look, from start, Jeremy, as we've implemented the recovery plan, as well as the rollout of our R4G strategy, Reinvent for Growth, the focus has really been on sustainable growth, on interventions that would take us into the future. So, you know, this is business and things are dynamic, things change all the time, but I can tell you the focus is certainly to ensure that we remain sustainable for the near future.
So moving into that near future then, what matters more to Transnet now? Is it fixing reliability for customers or fixing the balance sheet?
It's a bit of both, because the one requires the other, in fact. But for me, if you want to move volumes, the relationships with your customers is of critical and utmost importance. I think that's the focus for us, is to get the volumes moving. We don't make money if we do not move volumes. So that is, you know, operational improvements and continued improvement in operations. Sustainable improvement remains the focus. The balance sheet work continues because, you know, the balance sheet is not sustainable as it stands. So a lot of work that we've been doing, but we've been seeing the confidence from the market. So I believe that as we, you know, as we increase the one, we continue to work on the other one, that we will see changes, in fact, with both.
You talk about the balance sheet, Michelle, not being sustainable. With limited capital, then, what gets priority in the short term? Is it maintenance, expansion, or technology?
You'll find that the majority of our investment right now is centered or towards maintenance or sustaining capital, as we call it. I think probably it's around 85% of what we are investing is on the basis of rehabilitation of the networks. And of course, the rehabilitation of the high yielding network more than anything. But at the same time, we have applied for funding to support us with some of the other lines as well. You know that government has provided us with some funding for the iron ore corridor and the coal corridor, and we're making further applications for the others. So the focus really is on rehabilitation of the network, protecting the network from criminals so that we can move these volumes. And then we are spending some additional money as well on expansion.
Well, let's talk about security then. Losses in that respect, Michelle Phillips, do remain a drag. Are there urgent changes that you need to implement sooner rather than later that's going to move the needle in that respect?
Yes, so a lot of the work that we're doing currently are largely, I suppose, technology focused. We've been doing the hardening of the infrastructure by providing security, etc. But I think the secret is in the type of technologies that we will deploy. Of course, I can't say too much about it because the criminals are generally a step ahead. So there's a lot of work that we are doing with the security companies as well to ensure that we drive intelligence-driven operations and that we deploy technology, latest technology, as much as possible.
How close, Michelle Phillips, is Transnet at this point to allowing meaningful private access to freight rail? To what extent do you think you've made progress this year?
Well, you've seen the announcement of the 11 train operating companies who were given conditional award. We are working with them to get them onto the network sooner rather than later. They still are in the process of, sourcing the equipment and the like. We've tried to help in that respect as well. So, we are confident that we will see them coming onto the network as soon as they possibly can. Some of them have indicated 6 months, 12 months, 18 months. They've committed around 20 million tons for now. But we continue to run ad hoc processes, and I think that we will see a few more train operating companies sort of making the cut. So we are excited to introduce them onto the network. And then you know that, of course, on the port side, the transaction with ICTSI, I think, is a good one for us as well in terms of introducing private sector participation into the transit port terminal space.
The challenge, of course, is to make sure that gains in the port are not neutralized by rail bottlenecks. That's always going to be a problem,
yes,
isn't it?
Absolutely. So, it's a system that we run. We have to ensure that we don't move the bottlenecks further up the chain. So the work that we do is really integrated, running the system in an integrated way so that we can plan together both port and rail. There's no other way to run this business. You have to do it in an integrated planning way, definitely.
Michelle Phillips, what cultural shift within Transnet over the past year or so has been the hardest to execute?
Jeremy, we've got over 50,000 employees in the organization. It's important that we take them with us. We've spent a lot of time, engaging employees largely around how important they are to this business. They are our most valuable asset because we need them. Ultimately, they are the ones that move these volumes. And we've done a lot of, change work amongst our employees to bring them along. I believe, certainly, I've seen that there's a lot more excited people in the organization. They want to do the right thing. And we will see, certainly, the majority by far of Transnet employees working very hard to turn this around. I'm very pleased with what we've seen from our employees.
And if we have this conversation 1 year from now, is there a single outcome that's going to convince skeptics that your turnaround is now locked in?
Transnet needs to be in the black. That's it. We need to come out of a loss-making situation, and we need to show the country that with the right resources and the right support, both from government, our customers, our employees, that this business has a lot of potential and that it can be profitable.
Michelle Phillips, thank you very much indeed. Group Chief Executive at Transnet.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, this is an interesting one. Uber Eats' 2025 South Africa Cravings Report really reads like a food survey more than a social barometer. It shows fried chicken still dominating every city. No real surprises there. Grocery deliveries surging by 66%, and so-called super users placing thousands of orders a year. But I think behind the quirky stats that we're about to discuss, there are bigger questions about consumer behavior, convenience economics, digital etiquette, and the realities of gig work. And in that respect, from Uber Eats, I'm joined by Cassie Jagani. Cassie, a very warm welcome to you. Let's start with fried chicken, if we can. Tops every city, no real surprises there. I'm wondering if it's a resilience in local food culture, or maybe just a signal of stretched household budgets. What do you think it is?
So we're seeing across the report and quite unanimously across the country a deep love for fried chicken, accompanied with, and I think it's important to call it out, accompanied with pup, right? It is the most requested side alongside that fried chicken. I think to answer your question on what it speaks to, honestly, I think that there's an element where it speaks to both. You know, a large part of what our business looks at is, or what we track is seasonality. And we see different orders coming through depending on if it's the time of year or whether it is even the time of the month. So, you know, closer to the end of the month and the salary is a little bit more stretched, we see orders shifting more towards grocery items and maybe your cheaper faster food items. And in the beginning, when you know the money is fresh, a little bit more splurging happening. So I really think it's a testament to both the love for chicken, but also maybe, you know, trying to make the round go further.
What do you think is behind that big jump in grocery delivery?
Well, actually, Jeremy, I actually think it's, you know, a couple of years ago, we did our economic impact report we launched. And one of the key data points that came out of that was that the Uber Eats app is saving consumers more than 12.7 million hours by delivering meals and groceries directly to the door. And what we're seeing is a real push and a real acceleration in convenience culture trend, because that 12.7 million hours saved is time back in your pockets, which is something I think people find incredibly valuable. It's time to spend time with your family, with your kids, on your hobbies, you know, and not have to worry about, you know, making a run to a grocery store, etc. So really a very a big uptick in convenience culture and spending on convenience.
Cassie, on a more negative side, one user, if I've read this number correctly, placing nearly 2,800 orders, and that surely raises flags. Do you track the point where convenience turns into over-reliance? Because that is really off the charts.
Yeah, it's not necessarily something that we're tracking directly, but I do think, again, it comes back to the sense of convenience. You know, businesses are ordering Uber Eats to the office to feed employees, you know. Different party groups are, you know, if you've got friends over and you're ordering for a number of different people, you know, that is also one of the things that could be driving that increase that spike in the number of orders for this individual. But again, I think it really does come back to the sense that, you know, this is taking away the thought process for someone and the thought energy required around food and what's needed, right? Again, it speaks to that convenience culture and how more and more people are tapping into that.
You don't think 2,800 orders from one person is of any concern at all?
I think, like I said before, you know, it could be an office that's placing the order for many people. It might not be just for one person. It maybe came from one account, you know. So I think it requires maybe a little bit more of a deep dive, but there's a number of reasons why an order could have looked like that.
What do you make of Cape Town's late night ordering increasing so dramatically? Do you think it's lifestyle choice or people maybe just working and living on more non-traditional schedules?
Yeah, I think that, so just for the data, we saw that there was an increase. Almost Cape Town is the one city across South Africa that's ordering two times as much for late night orders. And late night being, you know, between 11 and about 2, 3 in the morning. I do think that it's tapping into an economy and into a market that was previously underserved, right? Because restaurants close, groceries close. And if you're someone who is working the night shift, if you're someone who's, you know, maybe gone out for the evening with some friends to have a good time, you know, we're being able to tap into an existing market. That market was always there, but now we're able to supply and give them an offering. So Cape Town seems to be the one driving that, yeah.
There's a boast that you make about a 48-second delivery, which obviously grabs headlines,
yes.
Cassie. But how do you balance speed with safety and fair working conditions?
Yeah, I think an excellent question. You know, our couriers are the backbone of our business. Our business does not exist without them. And I think from us to them is definitely a huge thank you. But we have a number of different safeguards that are in place for couriers to ensure that they're driving safely and that they're getting your order to you in a way that is safe. And it's a number of different things. Number one is, you know, driver hour limits. You know, they're only allowed to drive a set number of hours per day before we mandate that they take a rest. Other safety requirements are, you know, we're tracking things like speed, we're tracking things like, you know, the use of a helmet, the use of safety jacket and the necessary PPE as well to ensure that couriers are safe while they're executing these trips.
But only 2.3% of Johannesburgers, for instance, our orders include a please or a thank you, you say. Do you think anonymity changes the way in which how we treat people doing that work?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think that this is a comment maybe more broader on society in general, you know, with the uptick of things like social media and you being able to be anonymous on social media, people are bolder in what they have to say. But I think what our data is showing as well is that even within the anonymity, you know, there are cities that are still incredibly grateful, that are tipping more, that are, you know, acknowledging the work of their couriers. Joburg, Pretoria, Durban and Margate specifically topping that list, you know. So a huge thanks to them for, you know, sharing their gratitude.
Cassie Jagani, thank you very much indeed from Uber Eats. I do appreciate the time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Botswana has once again reinstated its ban on vegetable imports from South Africa, blocking key produce, including potatoes, onions, tomatoes and cabbage. The move, as I understand it, is aimed at protecting Botswana's domestic farmers, but it's obviously landed hard on South African producers who rely on regional trade to move surplus crops. In that respect, let's try and make some sense of this. I'm in conversation with Khotatso Nkadima, agricultural economist and commentator. Khotatso, a very warm welcome to you. Maybe let's just start with a broad picture. How big and important a market is this for South Africa?
Basically, the Botswana market is quite very important to our fresh produce farmers. It accounts to 15% of our overall vegetable import. So it's quite a very important market for South African vegetable farmers.
And how are you reading this move? Is it about food security or more about shielding inefficiencies in domestic production?
I would say it could be both. From what we can gather from the Gazette that Botswana published is that they would like to protect their domestic producers and they see that they have an oversupply of local production. But we need to also note that this is actually the second time in less than a year they have it. And the previous one didn't go well. We had limited consumer choice and also prices that were quite volatile also to the Botswana government, to the Botswana consumers and state. So it could be more. It's justifiable under political landscape. Localization, it's always what we preach and look forward to. But it's kind of very difficult to support it or justify it from economic perspective, considering that it was just abrupt and none of their trade partners saw it coming. So, yeah.
So difficult to justify, as you've said. Do you think this signals a broader shift then towards more protectionism or greater protectionism in the region?
Yes, I think it is. But it also just highlights other failures that are underlying within SACCO. The fact that we don't have a tariff board or other tribunal boards we can refer to in case of solving disputes. It seems like other small members that do not have any say in the tariff policy tend to then just resort, they feel, being economically squeezed. So it just shows that there's no credible at present.
Khotatso, who actually pays the price first? Is it farmers, retailers or consumers on either side of the border?
It's consumers on the side of Botswana. Because we know that Botswana is quite an arid state. So it has always relied on export to meet its demand. So if we have this rest kind of policies, import bans, it's normally the consumers who feel the heat first, starting with also prices being highly volatile. But also farmers that relied on this export market also tend to feel the pinch if they can't revert to other markets, as they would then be forced to reduce their prices.
So what do you think South Africa's response would be? The way I see it is that there are three ways of doing it. One is diplomatic pressure. There's either diversification or I guess we could retaliate.
I don't think retaliation would be a good measure at the moment. I think we just need to safeguard whatever that is left. They need to push more for formal SACCO consultations instead of this bilateral back and forth. You'd note that Namibia also had some restrictions against South Africa over the past few months. So there is a need for that formal SACU consultations where they can be able to just state out other systematic failures that lie within SACU, because it's not only a Botswana problem. It just gives us that this is just a symptom of other issues, more especially in Africa.
Do you think that food trade bans are becoming now a political tool rather than an economic one in Southern Africa?
Yes, yes. I think it's really is a political type of tool, because the spends are not really justified by any figures. Yes, they have stated that they would like to support their local farmers, and also there's oversupply within Botswana. But I'll just highlight those two. Within those two reasons that they gave, there isn't any figures that justifies or that shows other trade members to say our local supply has increased by this much. And also, we know that this is the second time they're doing it, but they also just don't highlight then how much they spend. So it's now kind of more political, especially because other trade partners, they're not given any chance to comment on the matter before it's even its implications whatsoever. So it's becoming more and more political, and it's just kind of sad to say it's only the locals or the people on the ground who will tend to feel the pinch.
And just a final question, if we see repeated bans like this, obviously it could discourage future agricultural investment in South Africa, surely?
No, not really. I think it will just lead to trade disruption or within SACU as a region. It exported quite a lot to Botswana, that's about 10 to 15%. But we do have quite a number of markets we can always shift to. So it's just a problem of needing more of a trade diversion at the moment. So with this abrupt restrictions, we would see less consistent supply to Botswana, because farmers would lose that hope or that market would alternate to other possible markets.
I'm going to leave it there with my thanks, Khotatso Nkadima, agricultural economist and a sector commentator. I do appreciate your time. Thank you.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, as annual insurance review notices land in our inboxes across the country, many of us are seeing higher premiums, revised excesses, and changes to our risk profiles, and it's happening all at once. And I think it's prompting a number of people to consider switching insurers. But the National Financial Ombuds Scheme says many motor insurance disputes, for instance, come down to exclusions that consumers didn't fully understand. There's a lot more to this argument. So let's try and make some sense of it. I'm in conversation with Michelle Jennings, Chief Executive of Glue. It's a financial services provider within Professional Provident Society. So Michelle, a very warm welcome. Premiums, as we know, are rising everywhere. So let's start with this. How do consumers know when switching is smart and when it's actually going to cost us more in the long run?
Thank you, Jeremy. Yes, today I am speaking as a consumer. So having been in that position myself where I need to consider whether it's smart or whether it is not, I've got the benefit of knowing how insurance businesses work. So I've got one recommendation to everybody, and that is to plan for this. Plan for renewal season just like you would for any large and important work project.
Many policies, Michelle, look cheaper up front, but when you've mined into the fine print, they would offer weaker benefits. What I'm wondering as we have this conversation, how big the gap is between what people think they're buying and what they actually get once they've signed the document?
And this is where I'm suggesting part of the planning is really, really doing your homework well. Insurers have got multiple ways that they can reduce premiums and make something look cheaper. What we're really looking for, though, is value. We want more benefits for the lowest possible premium. And I'll give you some examples. Insurers can keep the premiums lower by introducing things like higher excesses on your short term. There could be exclusions for things that you really should read in the fine print to see what is not covered. they can introduce waiting periods so that you actually have to give quite a little bit of time before you can claim. And sometimes there's just conditions that are not covered. Another thing to look out for is that there are premium patterns that your premiums may start off lower, but there's quite big escalations built in. So they quickly escalate again to levels that are unaffordable. So really, this does sit in the detail, and it's worth doing some homework to try and establish that.
Let me pick you up on exclusions, which, if I understand, are at the heart of most complaints against the insurance industry. Michelle, why are they still buried in the fine print instead of being better communicated in plain language?
I can't speak for all insurers, but I certainly can, from our perspective, we try and disclose those up front. So if we are excluding anything, we would like to list that in the policy schedule so that one can see immediately that that is an exclusion. What I would recommend, though, is that people work closely with their advisors. The advisors are very familiar with all of the different insurance businesses, and they know what types of exclusions may be embedded in that fine print, and they can highlight that to their clients, particularly if it is something that the client has highlighted as being important to them.
All right, so I'm going to sit down with my advisor as the renewal notice comes on my mail. What should that conversation sound like, and what key questions should I be asking of that advisor?
That's very interesting, and I suppose it goes back to that plan. The first thing to do is inform your advisor of your current status. What is it that you have at the moment in place for all of your insurance, your short-term insurance, your life insurance, your medical? Absolutely everything needs to be disclosed to your advisor so that he knows what you are currently covered for, what you are paying, and of course, sometimes it's uncomfortable, but disclose your affordability status as well. I think to do all of that upfront is critically important. And then to also share with them what your life stage needs are at that particular point and if they have changed year on year.
So let's talk about life stage changes, which I think are critical, and that is really germane to the whole reassessment process. Michelle, what are the most common gaps you see when people are in that stage, but they don't necessarily know what a life stage is? Actually means.
Perhaps I can give some examples in my personal life. My daughter turned 21 this year. So then she changed from being a minor on my medical aid to being an adult, and that was a massive jump in premium. So that is considered a life stage change. So something has changed drastically that impacts the premiums. My son got his driver's license, so now we need to add his vehicle, when he gets one, onto the policy. So that's a lifestyle change. So sometimes you think it's just, you know, going through things in life, but don't forget that they do have an impact on your insurance and the benefits that are required. And not just on the short-term side, but also on your life insurance cover as well. So my daughter finishing university, the short-term needs from our life policy are not different, because I would no longer need to fund her university fees going forward. So all of these sorts of things that take place in one's life actually do have an impact on your premiums and your needs going forward. And we need to be sure that we cover everything that we need to.
Michelle, I think it's safe to say that consumers often switch because they've had one bad experience with an insurer. Dangerous, of course, to make an emotional decision around insurance. It's got to be more data-driven.
Yes, and I think it's so important to be open to having a conversation with your insurer. I really do believe that insurers aren't there to try and, you know, disadvantage anybody. I really do believe that the intentions are good. So as long as you've got a good contact through your advisor and you can get hold of your insurance company, it's always a good idea to have that conversation with them first and see if they can rectify whatever it is that you are frustrated with.
Do you think insurers should be held more accountable for overselling cover without making the trade-off obvious?
Probably yes. I think it is important that insurers take some accountability. I think where it becomes a little bit more difficult is where there are independent financial advisors that us as insurers don't have the full reach to understand exactly what it is that they are disclosing and how they are prioritizing one insurer above the next. There's a lot of regulation that really does even the playing fields from a remuneration perspective. So, you know, it's not like any advisor is over-incentivized between one insurer and the next. And very often it's based on their experiences, the relationships that they have with the insurers, rather than bad advice or sending somebody to the wrong place entirely. What I do recognize, though, is that advisors are commission-based. So, you know, perhaps there is a little bit of overselling on their part to try and benefit themselves. But largely, these guys are good guys, and we really should give them the benefit of the doubt. You know, just work with them and make sure that we understand our needs so that when they do put a proposal on the table, we can make an informed decision, knowing what our needs are versus what it is that they are proposing for us.
I'll just need a quick answer. What's the single biggest red flag that tells you a cheaper premium is hiding a worse deal?
I think you need to understand what the premiums are going to look like going forward from a life insurance perspective. You know, look at the long-term projections. What are those premiums in 5, 10, 15 years? And then do a comparison.
Some good advice as we come to the end of the year. I've been in conversation with Michelle Jennings, Chief Executive of Glue. It's a financial services provider within the Professional Provident Society. Michelle, thank you very much indeed. Appreciate your time. And that is our program for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb. Your trusted source for business and investment insights.